Welcome to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley, and thank you so much for listening to my podcast. So much has happened since our last episode. George Floyd has been laid to rest, but certainly the issues brought around his murder have not. People are still out in the street. People are still protesting, mostly without violence. And that's interesting to note because certain networks, certain cable news outlets, in fact, show old footage of violence and then make it appear as though the violence is continuing. The fact of the matter is that George Floyd appears not to have died in vain. There are protests and outrage all over America and worldwide. And it certainly has spotlighted law enforcement overreach, starting with George Floyd's murder. Now, whether or not the sporadic violence that we do see has been instigated by Antifa or Boogaloo, or Antifa posing as Boogaloo, or Boogaloo posing as Antifa, we may never know. But certainly, the violent incidents have dropped drastically. And of course, there has also been, on a worldwide scale, serious questions raised about statues that are made in the image of slaveholders. And again, that takes place in England, and it has been brought into question right here in the good old USA as well. Now, I have to be honest, I thought that this would revert to a particular pattern, a pattern that I have seen many, many times throughout my career in radio. And that is simply this. The cop who killed George Floyd will go on trial along with the other three who are charged. And if history is any guide, they'll end up taking bench trials rather than jury trials. We'll talk about that shortly. Hopefully, those who have been participating in rallies and protests across the country and abroad will pay close attention to the outcome of those trials. That would include their sentences if they're found guilty. But once that's done, once the trials, once the verdicts, once the sentences are brought down, then what? What do you do? Again, if you look at history, and I tend to take a fairly pessimistic view of this, the media moves on, the protesters move on, and the next time it goes center stage is when another unarmed black man or woman is killed by police. This is a pattern that certainly has been prominent in American life for many, many years. I remember going back to 1973, the killing of Clifford Glover by a police officer. Clifford Glover was 12 years old. You fast forward to 1974, 15-year-old Randolph Evans, shot in the face by a guy who was found, a cop, by the way, who was found not guilty by reason of insanity. And the sad fact is, you can't really tell, and nobody asked at the time, why in the world somebody who is certifiable is actually serving in the New York City Police Department. That was amazing even then. But we've seen going forward, time after time after time, police officers shooting unarmed black people, going on trial, being acquitted, or having a slap on the wrists. I remember the cop who shot Eleanor Bumpers, who shotgunned Eleanor Bumpers in 1984, was promoted after he was not, I don't believe, even indicted for her murder. These are the historical markers leading up to George Floyd. And that's why I was pretty pessimistic. But now I'm starting to think maybe my pessimism has been misplaced. Maybe we're going through a different period in history now. Because people, thanks of course to the Black Lives Matter movement and many others across the world, fighting to see to it that another George Floyd does not, in fact, happen. That, in fact, Americans turn away from the notion that racially disparate policing is a consequence of a lower crime rate. In other words, if you arrest more black folks, if you convict more black folks, even of low-level crimes, that's okay because the crime rate is going down. Now, there are several examples of this that I know from personal experience in New York City. For years, and I'm talking about certainly through most of my lifetime. The number of blacks arrested on low-level marijuana charges is disparate and completely disproportionate to the number of whites. In fact, across New York City, that number stands at 8 times. In other words, blacks are arrested at 8 times the number of whites. For Latinos, the rate is 5 times the number of whites. In Manhattan, the rate jumps to 15 times the number of whites. And every study that I've ever seen seems to say, and does in fact say, that the number of blacks and whites who actually use marijuana are about the same. The rates are not all that different, certainly not 15 times different. And by the way, this is not according to me. This is according to a New York Times article in May 2018. And of course, beyond that, what's troubling is there's no correlation between weed arrests and serious crime. Even in the wake of the lockdown and curfews imposed in the city, people cited for violating social distancing rules and curfew rules were, again, overwhelmingly, I believe it was 81%, black and Latino. Until these patterns of policing are changed, little about policing will in fact change. It really is kind of as simple as that. There is a movement to reform and in some cases defund police departments. And of course, talking about defunding the police has prompted, certainly not unexpectedly, pushback from many quarters, from police unions, et cetera, and even from the President of the United States, who now is trying to use that politically to say that it's Democrats who favor defunding the police. Defunding is such an awkward term. They're talking about seriously reforming and reallocating resources within the police department. That's what they're talking about. And the fact of the matter is, that has worked out at least in one American city. Camden, New Jersey was once considered one of the most dangerous cities in America. They tore apart their police department. They didn't just defund it, they eliminated it and rebuilt it. And now they have a much lower murder rate, less than half, than what they had when they started. But you see, this is again about patterns. If you look at the New York City Police Department, if you look at police who are accused of killing unarmed black people, the one thing that jumps out at me anyway is the notion of bench trials. Police accused of shooting unarmed black people have two basic choices. They can ask for a change of venue, as the four cops did who fired 41 shots at Amadou Diallo back in 1999. They feared the possibility of a hostile Bronx jury, and they got their trials moved to Albany, the state capital, 140 miles north of New York City. They were acquitted. In many, if not most cases, cops opt for the second choice, which is called a bench rather than a jury trial. This means their fate is decided by one person, a judge, rather than 12. Every American, and this we need to be clear about this, every American charged with a crime has the absolute right to choose a bench trial. And I certainly am not one who are going to say, well, the cops have to give up that right, or we need to change the law or the Constitution or whatever has to be changed so that cops alone don't have that option. I think if every American has the right to choose a bench trial, so too do the police. But few non-police citizens choose a bench trial because the perception is that they're more likely to be convicted. Because a judge is more likely to believe a police officer who testifies at a trial than an alleged wrongdoer. When it's down to the police, it appears the opposite is true. There are a number of reasons for this. Police work hand in hand with prosecutors and judges every day. In a place like the Bronx, for example, where the word of a cop isn't taken as gospel, it makes sense to take your chances with law enforcement apparatus that might seem to be friendly, certainly to your case. In several high-profile cases over the years, it doesn't even get that far. Grand juries in some cases don't even end up indicting cops accused of wrongdoing. In case after case, communities of color are told through the actions of the justice system that their concerns, and yes, even their lives, don't matter. Sad to say, it's going to take more than defunding police departments to change this dynamic. There are 18,000 police agencies in the United States, 18,000 different jurisdictions. Yet there are certain aspects and certain elements of police culture that seem to run true across most of those 18,000 agencies. And that's what needs to change, the culture of policing. And that's going to take work. That's going to take work after the cameras are turned off. That's going to take work after the justifiable anger over the murder of George Floyd recedes. In almost any organization, people who violate the dominant culture are shamed, shunned, not made, to feel welcome. Until the police show a complete intolerance for race-based policing, things will not change. I'm not even sure defunding departments politically is a smart idea, because Donald Trump is already using it to pillory Democrats. Reallocating police resources would have been a much smarter way to position these types of changes. Many of them may well be necessary. But what fundamentally needs to change is the attitude and culture of policing. Otherwise, we will continue to have these situations like George Floyd, in many cases without the benefit of a video showing a cop putting his knee to the neck of a man for 9 minutes. And the sad truth is, the protests will go on, but nothing will fundamentally change. Join the conversation on my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Got a different opinion? Love to hear it. When we come back, COVID-19. Is easing lockdown working across America? This is The Intersection. Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley, and again, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. COVID-19 appears to have been almost overwhelmed by the protests around the murder of George Floyd. Yet, COVID-19 is still with us, and one of the issues that joins the two is whether the lack of social distancing at protests around the nation and the world could end up spreading the virus even as lockdown restrictions are being eased. In point of fact, the social distancing component of the effort to contain the virus has been the first to go. And it's not just at protests, on beaches, even among the White House press corps. It's being observed less and less. Although, in fairness to the journalists, the White House set chairs at closer than the recommended 6 feet distance. What's interesting about this as well is that in some parts of the world, they are now talking about, and some places have even implemented, a shorter distance. In other words, 3 feet instead of 6 feet. It's going to take time to figure out if this easing and the easings that are sure to come will cause a spike in infections and a spike in deaths. Some states, like Florida, have already seen increases. And of course, Florida was a state that came out of lockdown relatively early. As these easings continue, some people are looking back to assess whether politicians should be held accountable for decisions made in defiance of science. And there's always, folks, whether we want to admit it or not, there's always going to be a tension between science and politics. Politicians have certain concerns that scientists don't have. Scientists, I'm not going to say they don't care whether the economy rebounds, but that's not their primary concern. Their primary concern is to look at data and say, or predict, if they can, what is to come. And on that level, they are always going to be at loggerheads with politicians who say, look, we can't stand to keep the economy shut down for extended periods of time, no matter what the risk, which of course led to the absurd, and I emphasize absurd, notion that people should be prepared to die to help the economy, which more than one present and former politician posited in the weeks past. Now, it's interesting to me, when we look at all this, that politicians, unlike scientists usually, if they mess up or if they predict something that turns out not to be the case, they'll admit it. At least the honest ones will. Politicians, on the other hand, being who they are, very few, if any, will admit responsibility for mistakes. And to be fair, the science about wearing masks, for example, and even the potential severity of the coronavirus has changed over time. And by that I mean there were some scientists who said at the very beginning, this is not going to be that bad. We do know that it has been and is that bad. Nearly 7 million confirmed cases of coronavirus worldwide and almost 400,000 deaths. Those who thought a vaccine was in the works, maybe not. Scientists are saying, think again. One scientist quoted in the Guardian newspaper says a vaccine, quote, is a hope, not a strategy. There's more hope, however, for antiviral drugs. Several trials in different countries are promising, but not yet ready for widespread use. Regardless, some countries, notably New Zealand, have made significant progress despite the obstacles. And one of the things that fascinates me about New Zealand, which has gone a period of time with no new coronavirus cases, is that the prime minister of that country jumps up and says, well, you know what? We probably will have cases going down the road, and we are going to prepare now for that possibility. We're not just going to sit back and revel in the fact that we don't have any cases. Can you imagine leaders in the United States saying something like that? I don't think so. No matter what, and no matter who the politician is, and no matter how much they praise themselves in their responses, there is a significant fact. We know a lot less about this scourge than we should know. It all comes down to health in the form of tight restrictions versus the economy, which threatens to crater, despite last week's good job news in the United States. So we do have to ask ourselves, how do we balance these two competing interests? In England, a 14-day quarantine has been imposed on people entering the country from abroad. Needless to say, the airline industry and many other groups are not happy about that. So unhappy are they, in fact, that they're thinking about suing. But back in the US, we have to ask ourselves if the roles of hero and villain haven't been reversed during the course of this pandemic. And I'm not talking about all wealthy people, but many of the rich people we look up to, and when I say we look up to, I mean we envy their wealth in many cases, have found out one thing the rich have, and that is that COVID-19 doesn't care how much money you have. On the other hand, people we often overlook, people who don't make a lot of money, have turned out to be the real life heroes. Caregivers, and caregiving is a very widely cast net, from doctors to nursing home workers, etc. And many of them on the lower end of the pay scale don't get paid much, okay? But the fact of the matter is they're a special group of human beings. Many of them have risked their own lives in service of other people on a daily basis. Some of them have to worry about whether or not they're gonna have to pay for the COVID-19 tests that they are now required, I emphasize, required to get in certain places. For example, in New York, nursing home workers have to be tested twice a week. Where's the money gonna come from, they ask, because sometimes their insurance won't pay. Sometimes the nursing homes say they can't pay. So does that mean that the caregiver, the heroic caregiver, then has to pay in order to be tested, in order to perform the service they perform? Those folks, those caregivers, those are my heroes. What about you? Got something on your mind? Message me on Facebook at Mark Riley Media. And finally, when we come back, what will the new normal be when the coronavirus has run its course? This is The Intersection. Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. Sooner or later, the world is going to get past COVID-19 and back to normal. The question I have is, what will that normal actually be? For example, online retailers like Amazon have made out like bandits during the pandemic. Will brick and mortar retailers close in higher numbers than they already are closing? Because the fact of the matter is, they weren't doing smashingly well even before the pandemic. What will that mean to urban centers in cities across the country? Does that mean that downtown neighborhoods, many of whom managed to revitalize themselves, will they now face a specter of empty storefronts like they did during the height of the 2008 recession or even back before that? These are very real questions, and they have daunting implications for cities across America and, in fact, across the world. Even with last week's good news about unemployment in the U.S., it could take months, even years, for retail consumption to get back to where it once was. If these big stores do close, what will take their place? And trust me, something will, in fact, take their place. But what will it be? Another question, will more and more people work from home permanently? Some companies have already realized they can cut massive real estate costs by keeping only essential workers, I hate to use the term, essential workers in offices. The entertainment business is another industry that might be permanently changed by the pandemic. I saw a real interesting story the other day. It said essentially that the city of San Francisco, which is one of the most expensive cities in America in which to live, has seen a better than 9% decline in rental rates because suddenly people in Silicon Valley are realizing, and companies in Silicon Valley, more important, are realizing that more and more of their people can in fact work from home. And suddenly, those rental rates, and particularly in areas around the headquarters of some of the major companies like Google and Apple, which are based in California, many of them are finding that their rental rates are dropping like a stone. In some cases, double-digit decreases. Is that going to be permanent, or will they bounce back? And by the way, the median rent in San Francisco for a one-bedroom apartment is over $3,300 a month. That's right, $3,300 a month. The entertainment business, another industry that might be permanently changed by this pandemic. And this, of course, is something that is near and dear to my heart because I know a lot of people that work in the entertainment business. I know the anxiety that they're going through right about now, trying to figure out how to make ends meet, whether or not they can access whatever government stimulus exists, and whether or not they can actually hold the line until things ease up a little bit and they're allowed to reopen. Many of them, if not all of them, I'm talking about venues now, have had to shut down for the past 5 or 6 months. While the film and television industries will likely move forward fairly quickly, what about theater? While New York may be the theater capital of the U.S., and by the way, they are predicting in New York that theater won't get back to normal this year. In other words, 2021 will be the earliest time that you can see a Broadway show. There are literally thousands of small regional and local theaters, small regional dance troupes, etc., theatrical groups that were barely making it before the virus hit. They'll essentially be starting from scratch. So too will many of the clubs, pubs, bars, and restaurants that have been closed for months since the pandemic began. Many clubs and DJs have made ends meet by innovations like live streaming mixes over various platforms. Will this continue even after clubs reopen? Maybe not, because a lot of those DJs are going to want to get back behind turntables in front of audiences. But when will that happen? You know, it's very difficult to socially distance in a club. It really is. Now, you can socially distance in a restaurant because people can put up barriers to people sitting too close together. It's very difficult to put up barriers that prevent people from dancing too close together. Does that mean that there's going to have to be some form of innovation to make things work in the future? Maybe it will be. Not sure what they'll end up being, but the bottom line is there may have to be serious innovations to bring that segment of the economy back. Will these changes have the effect of bringing people together rather than isolating them? Because people who don't care for online shopping, for example, or the online experience generally in making purchases, make the argument that there's an aura of coldness, an aura of distance, an aura of isolation that comes with online shopping that you don't get when you're in a store. Some people like really get excited going to stores and participating in that sort of communal shopping experience. Is that going to be lessened? Will it be gone altogether? I doubt seriously it will be gone completely. But I do have a feeling we'll see some big changes in our day-to-day lives going forward. We may like some, we may not like others. But as always, time marches on. Thank you so much for listening. The executive producer of The Intersection is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. Till we meet again, please stay well.